There are many ways to travel around the world, but what is so specifically glorious about the road trip? The romance of hitting the wide open road has sparked the imaginations of writers and directors since the dawn of the highway. The journeys might take longer than in a plane or a train, but in your car, restrictions are lifted. You can take wrong turns that turn out to be the right ones, meet weird and wonderful folk, and get up close and personal with your surroundings. You might have a destination in mind, or maybe you just want to see where the ride takes you. Maybe an unexpected twist in the road or the story will lead you to places you've never otherwise explored. You're listening to The Road Ahead in association with Audi. In each episode, we'll be exploring different paths around the world across four different continents. This week...
It's paradise. It's not for everybody, for sure. But I would give it a try and definitely come and visit, you know, anytime. Make the trip. It's always worth the journey.
We're in Scotland. The route... We'll be traversing the Highlands, starting in Inverness and ending up on the Isle of Skye. We'll be exploring what this majestic island has to offer. The journey we're taking today is famous for its dramatic landscapes, from the large lochs that may or may not be inhabited by mythical monsters to the hills that tumble over each other to make way for snow-capped mountains, if you're in the right season. We're here in the autumn and the colour palette is rich. Flashes of crimson, copper, amber, russet, vibrant mustard yellow mountains become bare mauve forests as you twist through corners, and the blue of that water, well, it's pretty darn blue. Scotland is known for its myths and legends. Whether it's kings, fairies or monsters, the Highlands are rich with stories. To get us in the mood for this trip, we enlisted the help of local Inverness guide Andrew MacDonald. He picked us up in his tour taxi before we hit the road ourselves to explain a bit about these mysterious tales.
Inver is a corruption of a Gaelic word, Inibir, and means at the mouth of. So it features in all the Gaelic, you know, all the Celtic countries, Ireland. And so Inverness means at the mouth of the Ness, and Vergari at the mouth of the Garry. So the River Ness here was the very first sighting of the Loch Ness monster, so-called. St. Columba and his followers brought Christianity to the Highlands, and one of his servants was apparently attacked by a sea serpent, but that was in the River Ness, not in the loch. So ever since there's been multiple sightings of the beastie. One would imagine there must be two of them if they're still in the go all these thousands of years later. If you're going down by Loch Ness, your first 20 miles will be, 16 of them will be along the side of Loch Ness. And you'll very easily see that the whole of the Great Glen is a geological fault line. And it was caused by, at one time, Scotland was actually joined to the North American continent. And the tectonic plates moved and Scotland floated away and collided with England. And some would say we've been trying to detach ourselves ever since. The lochs at Loch Ness, Loch Oich, Loch Long, Loch Linney were joined by Thomas Telford with 26 miles of canal, giving a navigable channel from the North Sea to the Atlantic, which is very significant for fishing boats and small craft, because going through between Orkney and the mainland, that stretch of water is the Pentland Firth, and it's one of the most dangerous stretches of water in the world. There's 9 currents meet there because the North Sea and the Atlantic meet, and almost a Bermuda Triangle. You know, there was a boat loaded with concrete just a few years ago, just disappeared. Obviously, the weather and the weight, the thing, there's been no sign of it. Or the people. But then back in the day, there was no road network as such, and the lochs were the highway, because many of the clans, including my clan, are descended from the Vikings. Somerled, the Viking chief, had three sons, Donald, Dougal, and Ranald. So if you're maybe aware that the prefix Mac means son of. So MacDonald is son of Donald, MacDougal is son of Dougal, and so on. And these people were used to using the Viking galleys, but they developed a different boat, which was called a berlin, but it looked like a miniature galley, and either 50 or 100 oarsmen in a single sail. So when there was no road network, they used the lochs as the road network, and when they got the end of a loch, they carried the boat to the next loch. So fairly able fellows.
Fairly.
Yeah, on one occasion, apparently, they carried the whole of the Highland Navy over the Pass of Brander in Argyll in wintertime. Right. So it doesn't bear thinking about.
We'll hear more from Andrew a little later on, but right now he's got us in the mood to jump in our car and get driving.
The sound of the lapping water you can hear is the sound of Loch Ness. We can see some coppery shallows here on the southeastern side. We've taken, never decide what the high road and the low road is. The most pretty road, it's a single track road. We're just south of Foyers, having started at Dores, and we're heading towards Skye. We've taken an opportunity to jump out of the car while it's relatively fortuitous, the weather, and dry. And of course we're looking for a monster. Who isn't looking for a monster when they're standing on the banks of this famous loch, the most famous in the world, maybe the most famous body of water in the world, with one very dubious resident? Most people come here searching for Nessie or just looking for beautiful countryside and good food and beautiful views through the late summer, and they have to fight off 1,000 midges. We're here in autumn and the colours couldn't be more beautiful. It's a wonderful time that this road sort of comes into its own perhaps at this time of year because it's quiet. You can drive, you can see the view, and we head into it, into the mouth of the loch.
And you're seeing your journey to Skye, and some of the oldest rock in the world is in the north end of Skye, where the Jurassic rock has forced its way through the sandstone, leaving, for all the world, pleats like the kilt. And maybe on your agenda is the kilt rock.
Yeah.
That's on the Trotternish Peninsula. So, and dinosaur footprints are found in the Kerang there as well.
And we're looking out over the Kyle of Loch Alsh, and we're just shy of the Skye Bridge. We can see some tugs and some fishing boats, some salmon nets in the loch. We're looking out over the bridge that only recently has linked Skye to the mainland of Scotland. It was a ferry, then it was a train, then it was a number of ways of getting over the water. And we look at the dotted white houses of Kyle Ekin. Is that blue sky in the distance?
After a breathtaking cross-country journey, we arrive, shaking the rain from our hair, on the southeast of Skye, where its bridge takes us from the highlands to the islands. Here our landscape changes. Fewer trees, the land stretches further, not flat but not as rollingly mountainous, though that will surely change again soon. Heather bristles in the wind, playing tricks on you. Everything feels alive. After half a day of driving, we arrive hungry. Some Cullen skink, that smoky fish soup to you and I, eaten by a roaring fire in a local pub, will soon fix that. And we decide to end our day at Skye's newest whiskey distillery, named Torabeg, to find out how the mystical terrain of this island affects Scotland's most famous drink. Don't worry, I'm not the designated driver for the journey home. The building took our interest because of its location, a former 17th century farmstead right on the edge of Moor Water. We roll up and happen across one of its distillers, Iona.
So you were trained up by this new distillery to be a distiller What are the first things they teach you? Is it a tasting lesson? Is it about the grain? What on earth are you kind of doing when you have your first steps as a distiller?
I mean, they'll take you through the process. We had Chris Anderson teaching us. So he's a master distiller. He's been a manager of many different distilleries across Scotland. And he taught us what we're looking for in the likes of the barley, what his standard would be when we're mashing, and just takes us through this process step by step. And he taught us until he was happy that we were confident.
And what's the best bit of that? I mean, I've kind of got an educated guess as to what the nicest bit of it all is, but what's been the most satisfying part for you?
I enjoy the distilling side of things because you can actually see your product. You can see the spirit coming through the safe at the end. We ferment our wash for 60 hours. And so you're waiting all that time, and then eventually you finally get the spirit. So that's quite a good feeling. So I'd say that's my favourite part. Yeah.
And so what are the what kind of colours? What's on our palate when we're tasting the island blend, which is the one that you hope to make the single malt from, or make it taste like?
There's a finish of peat smoke. Yeah. So an island whisky is a peated whisky. You know, that's your traditional flavour. So kind of ashy, peaty taste at the end. You can get some fiery notes in there, but you can also get some surprising notes there too, so some woody flavours as well. We mature the spirit in American oak casks, bourbon casks, so you get some sweetness from the bourbon also.
So you've got a visitor centre. You've obviously done this before. You've talked to people before, but it's kind of part and parcel of your job, but doing the distilling, the making, the tasting, all the rest of it is kind of part of the job. How does this stuff rank? People are obviously interested in the process. It's such a kind of mystical drink, you know, that you've got to be prepared to have people ask those questions. How is it speaking to people about doing your job when you're just trying to do your job?
I really like everything to do with the whiskey industry. I love it. I'm really interested in all the science, and I like sharing it with people. So however deep people want to go with the science of things, I can tell them, and I enjoy learning from people that have been working in the industry longer than I have, and they have more knowledge than me, so I'll talk about it till I'm out of breath, so it's fine.
And what about, I mean, it's a very busy shelf in any supermarket, in any off-license, all over the world, in duty-free shops, all over the world, people love this stuff, it's famous. Obviously, you've got to find your niche, Torvik. What do you see that as being when you've got a famous cousin up the road in Talisker and stuff? How do you set yourselves apart?
People say that tasting a dram is like an experience. It takes you back to the first time you've ever tasted that dram. So if we can make people feel comfortable when they come and visit us, hopefully they'll carry on liking our whiskey and going back to that. So we'd like to be not just a one-off dram, you know, we want to carry on being someone's favourite dram.
What is it about Skye itself, a land of many myths and mists, what is it about Skye that kind of lends itself to this? Because it's a product that's based on a lot of myth, as I say, the island itself must help with that.
Yeah, so I think a big factor is the sea. You see, no matter where you go in Skye, you're never far from the sea, so that's maybe a factor in the rough landscape of the land as well. Maybe be a factor as well. But myself, I was born here, so I've lived elsewhere, and it's not quite the same. So I came back. So you know, I wouldn't move.
After our trip to the distillery, well, it's bedtime. A thunderstorm roars its way across the island as we lay snug in our beds, the perfect atmosphere for a bedtime story. Earlier that day, Andrew MacDonald had driven us through a creepy cemetery and told us about the Standing Stones, inspiration for Diana Gabaldon's Outlander novels.
This street that we're on now is Balaferry, which in Gaelic is three words, Balia y Ferry, which means the place of the fairies. And it is so called because of Tomnihurich Hill, which is just this hill in front of us here. And Tomnihurich in Gaelic again means the hill of the yew trees. But the hill is supposed to be inhabited by fairies. And two pipers, one of the myths that surrounds this hill, and there's many surround the hill, one of them is that two pipers were going home from a wedding and they were invited into the hill by the fairies to play for their hootenanny, so all was up for a bit of a ceilidh. The pipers say, yeah, okay, that'll be fine. So they go into the hill and they're with the fairies for 2 days, wining and dining and carousing. And then they say, well, that was very nice, thanks very much, we'll go home now. And the fairies say, no, no, it doesn't work like that. You can't go home, you have to stay with us. But if you stay with us, you'll be granted eternal life. All very well, says the pipers, but the wife will be looking for us, so we'll have to go. And they exit the hill, whereupon they discover that 200 years have passed. But this time the 200 years go forward, and they find that nobody knows them. They're dressed in clothes that are out of their time. Their houses are no longer there. Their friends are no longer there. So they die of a broken heart and crumble to dust.
Day two, and after an early start that seems to be to-ing and fro-ing between torrential rain and glorious sunshine, it's time to get back on the road to head up island. Today we're driving north along the incredible east coast of Skye. We'll pass famous sights such as the Kerang and the Old Man of Stour. We'll fly by dinosaur footprints and watch seals, dolphins and whales sing and swim off the coast. We're heading up to meet Katie Tun, an English artist and marine conservationist who moved to Skye 4 years ago after falling for its wilderness.
And you join us in Katie's studio, pretty much near the north of Skye, and we can hear the wind chasing down the chimney in here. We're surrounded by your beautiful blue artworks and all sorts of bones and paraphernalia. It's the epitome of an artist's studio. Is the work you're making here, is it completely riffing off your idea of Skye, what you see out the window, what you see in the sea and things?
Completely, I'd say. When I first moved up here, I was a military portrait painter. So I came up drawing people, horses, and I found that I spent my whole time kind of looking at the back wall, looking at a canvas, just drawing that. And I thought, you know, I need to, in some way, kind of connect my love of the ocean and marine conservation. And kind of through a little bit of experimenting, I kind of turned away from portraiture, and this is where I ended up.
Could you do this anywhere else if you had to kind of go off and take a sojourn in London or in any other part of Scotland or the world? Would you be making the same stuff, or is this kind of delve right down into your sort of Skye experience?
Maybe not Skye, but islands. So it's very much it's inspired by when you look down into the ocean and you see kind of a patch of white sand and it makes everything really luminous, or if you look up at the night sky and you just get the clear Milky Way and stuff like that. So I guess if I moved into like the highlands or forestry area, I'd probably end up doing green things and kind of reds and golds of heather and stuff. So it's definitely part of being here.
We can say that you're a kind of connoisseur of the place in which you live, because people will notice that you haven't got the Skye accent, the Highland accent, the Scottish accent at all, in fact. You moved up here because you fell in love with the place. So tell us how that happened. You've been here for a few years. It's an unusual, windy, beautiful spot here. Wouldn't be everyone's cup of tea. Tell us about your journey up here.
I hadn't intended to stay up here. It was supposed to be a six-month break from London. I thought I'd come up, maybe close the windows, put a fire on, get a good book, do some writing. And then once I'd done a winter, I thought, well, I'll just see it for a little bit longer. And then after a summer, I thought, well, I'll just do one more winter. And I think it's just home really now. And it's different, but you get used to it. And I think it sounds really cheesy, but you've got to work out what you like and what makes you happy and then get close to it. And for me, it's being by the wildlife, being by the sea, being able to swim and make my art up it.
You said swim, people's ears will prick up because people will have, all over the world listening to this, an idea of what the temperature is like. The temperature of the sea is like, it's very beautiful, but it's not the warmest place in the world. Tell us about the swimming. How did you get, has that been something you've always done, or did you get into it through being on Skye or being up in Scotland? How did that start?
I'm not sure, really. I think there's something about, maybe it's because the water up here is so clear that you see it and there's just a, you just think, I need to get in that. And I mean, it is absolutely freezing. But you, one of my rules of life is that you never feel bad after a cold water swim. You never regret it. But you just feel so invigorated by it. And I think it's just, there's something quite, I don't know, freeing and mischievous about walking up a hill and kind of enjoying the view and then suddenly going, oh, I see a really cool, like, bright blue pool and just stripping off and just plunging in.
And I wanted to ask you about this because you're involved in more ways than one with your art, and some of the inspiration for that is obviously the landscape, the wildlife, and part of the reason you moved up here. But also you work with marine conservation mm-hmm. in quite a hands-on way occasionally when it's needed. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, about how many people it takes to lift a seal pup or a whale and put them back in the sea with their mother, with their pod or whatever.
I started volunteering with British Divers Marine Life Rescue, which is it's the charity that you call if anything washes up on the beach or if you get a sick seal, if you get a stranded dolphin. So I'm a marine mammal medic with them, and that's, as you say, kind of lifting things back into the sea, although it's a lot more complicated than that. Porpoises, they're quite small, you know, they're like... Mm. I don't know, size of a toddler, they're quite easy. You can kind of put them under an arm and put them back out. A pilot whale's not quite the same, but we do things like that. I do beach cleans, organising beach cleans and talking in schools about stuff. Because obviously we're really connected to the sea here. There's so much coastline that, I mean, you go for a walk and you see the rubbish, or you stand on top of a cliff and you see the whales. So it's nice to be right in the thick of it, but you also see how much needs changing and actually how precious and how delicate stuff is at the same time. It can be quite an emotional process, but they're amazing animals to work with. We don't have any means to calm down apart from our own kind of voices and keeping calm, so you're all very quiet around the whales, yeah. And you have to sing to them and be very gentle, and they really respond well to female voices and talking, which is beautiful but also incredibly heartbreaking because it just shows that they're very aware. I say that that you have to be very careful around them with their tails thrashing, but they're also very aware that you're helping them, which is it's a pretty moving and special thing to experience. I don't think I'll ever forget the first time that I started talking to a whale and it opened its eye and just looked at me, like that recognition and that registering, just, yeah, heartbreaking as well.
We end our journey in Steen, a small coastal town where we find the island's only Michelin-starred restaurant, the Loch Bay. The place is run by Michael Smith, a Highland chef who returned to the north to escape the fast-paced life of London kitchens. Smith is getting back in touch with nature, ingredients, and of course, the fishermen.
So all of the food you're finding, hopefully, in any of the establishments on Skye, for one, it's coming straight from where it's been caught, where it's been grown.
Yeah.
The irony is, if we want to have prawns or lobster, we phone the boats up directly, and we speak to the fishermen who are actually physically catching them with their own bare hands.
Yeah.
When we season that with some lemon, we have to order the lemons 3 days in advance. So that's the irony, but hey, sometimes you can eat lobster and prawns without lemon, so it's not too much a big deal.
So it's not too much for drag, but you haven't got too many lemon groves here. On Skye, or am I going to be slapped in the face with fact here?
No, we don't. We have a multitude of micro growers who grow wonderful herbs, yeah. Lettuce. If we could grow lemons, for sure we would grow them, right?
But yeah.
There's a huge diversity of stuff that's available. But the key is the freshness and the terroir. It's the environment which those things have been growing in naturally. So it's the wilderness.
And how do you when you start off doing this? Being a chef and then being a chef with your name over the door, like yourself, how do you start those relationships with the fishermen, with the growers, all the rest of it? Is that the toughest thing to keep going? Because the cooking is tough enough as it is, keeping a menu, keeping people interested, doing all the things that kind of keep this a real famous and going concern. But what about those little relationships and always the undersung thing about, I presume, being a chef in a kitchen, keeping those relationships going?
Well, establishing them, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Establishing those relationships is key. So you want to identify people of a like mind. They are respectful of the environment. They're respectful of nature. When I first came to Skye, you suddenly get introduced to people who are fishermen who have been here for maybe two or three generations. So maybe meet them in the pub's quite a good start. Buying them a few pints, maybe a couple of drams.
Yeah.
But there's a general respect for the environment. I think that's the entry to any conversation with suppliers and chefs, for example. So once you establish that mutual respect, and you're happy maybe not to buy the cheapest products, but the best products you can buy for your business, once you establish those relationships, like I have with my lobster fisherman, who's just right out the front of the restaurant here, the lads in Dunvegan who fish out of boats. They're three generations of fishermen for prawns, for crab, for oysters, and all those wonderful things. We speak with each other literally day by day. If the weather's not good, they can't go out and fish. We need to know that because we need to say we're going to have prawns in our menu or langoustine in our menu or lobster. So you have to have a legitimate, honest, direct relationship with your suppliers. You need to feel as if you can phone up Kevin on the prawn boat tomorrow, a grumpy prawn fisherman who's been out all week in a hurricane and say, I need another dispatch of prawns, please. You need to go out in the perfect storm to get prawns for us to cook for our customers. Well, probably he'll just turn around and say, right, you need to buy him an extra couple of pints in the pub tomorrow night.
Yeah, okay. That's good. That's a kind of good bribery-based business process, which I'm glad still exists and we're proud to fly the flag for.
That's business. That's just purely business.
It is.
But it's genuine. Yeah. That is what happens.
Yeah. And what are the things on the menu that you... What are the regulars on your menu that are that kind of showcase Skye's fauna and flora and kind of seafood then? What are the things that... Because you've moved here, this is your restaurant for a reason. You're making stuff that presumably is very unique to the island in a lot of cases with your menu.
Well, we always try and have all of the things from the sea. So that's crab, lobster, prawns, shrimp. Anything that's caught by the boats that are harbored here on Skye, we always try and have those all the time in the menu. So we have one menu specifically for the indigenous seafood of Skye because it's the best in the world. The other menu we have, we try and incorporate as many of the wild produce that's available. So that's the game, the deer, the venison, any of the game birds when they're in season, mallard, all of those things. We want to represent, without sounding too pretentious, the wilderness, the nature's bounty is what we're always trying to have on the menu here.
And you're at the end of a long road here in Steen. Your restaurant's got such a simple name. It's in such a beautiful place. Part of you is difficult to find. Part of it, that must work very well in your favour. And that's me probably saying that in a position of ignorance, sitting in London saying that. But there is some great satisfaction at the end of a long road, having the most wonderful supper. Does that work in favour for you? Do you sometimes scratch your head and think, I need to be able to do more or be closer to this, that and the other, or what?
Well, I'm very fortunate that... we've been on the island 13 years, living here with a family, with young children who have grown up on the island. But before that, previously, I was in London, so I was there for 10 years. Nowadays, what I find is, it's fantastic. We go and access culture, let's call it civilization in inverted commas, in somewhere like London or a major city in Europe or anywhere in the world. We can go there for a weekend, and we access that culture for a weekend. And then after that couple of days or 3 or 4 days, we feel a yearning to go, well, do you know what? We really need to go back to the space, back to the wilderness. We need some peace. We need some headspace. So the wonderful thing is when you live here, you're able to do that. You're able to access culture of that kind of style and degree in a city and know and be reassured that you're going to come back and have peace and tranquility. There's not too many people about. There's not traffic jams, those sort of things that stress people out, right? Yeah. So if you enjoy living that existence, it is paradise. It's not for everybody, for sure. But I would give it a try and definitely come and visit, anytime. Make the trip. It's always worth the journey.
What beauty the Highlands have given. You could drive around for days and never be bored by the changing colours, jagged edges and dramatic weather this place has to offer. An island ever-changing under scudding clouds, singing sun, horizontal rain and waterfalls that burst out from the mountain's very seams. Because the place is wild, the hospitality is that much warmer, or seems it. Skye makes for hardiness, but Skye makes for friendliness too. And while that brings us to the close of our Scottish chapter, we'll end things with the next instalment of The Shamanist, a short story by Lawrence Osborne.